We're about to have a conversation with delegate and physician Dan Morheim, who represents the 11th District in Baltimore County. He's an emergency room physician. And Dan, you've been in the legislature for 12 years now, is that right?
Actually, Mark, 22 years.
22? Excuse me, 22.
I'm deputy majority leader in the House, among other things.
Got you. So you've introduced these bills, which I think that when I first heard about them, were pretty extraordinary in terms of, because I mean, we've had conversations over the years together on the air and in person just about what drugs are doing in our society and the war on drugs and where that's taken us. But this is beyond the conversation to me of legalization. It's trying to figure out how to get through this morass. So let's talk about, before we start, define for a moment a notion you'll probably raise a lot during the course of our short conversation, which is harm reduction. Just define what that means for our listeners. Then let's jump into your bills.
Sure. Thank you, Mark. The war on drugs has caused a great deal of harm, not only to people with substance abuse problems, but to the rest of society. Jam prisons, spread of disease, it's been going on for 50 years, shocking levels of crime and violence locally, nationally, internationally, billions of dollars spent to incarcerate people, billions more spent on drugs themselves. And for all of that, what do we have to show? The rate of drug use has not gone down. It's worse than ever. So it's come to a point where you just have to acknowledge that it's time to change and to look at some new strategies, strategies that have worked elsewhere. Everything I'm going to share, there's good data behind them. So harm reduction is twofold. It's harm reduction for the substance abusers themselves and their immediate families and the people around them in their communities. But it's harm reduction for everybody else because substance abusers drive so much social dislocation. We're paying tremendous amounts in the criminal justice system. We're paying tremendous amounts in the healthcare system. It's destroying communities. People, business people don't want to invest in communities where there's a lot of drug problems and so on. And then, frankly, it's, you know, ruining lives. And there's a spiritual and loss and a family loss that you can't quantify in dollars. So these bills are all designed with the focus of harm reduction. It's not a fix. It's not a cure. There's no silver bullet that's going to make everything turn around overnight. Nobody's that naive. This is just about decompressing through various strategic means this failed policy and trying to move in a different direction.
So let's go through some of this. I think the first thing I read about was what I think is your House Bill 1119, use of possession of controlled dangerous substances. This is we had the debate over decriminalization and issues around marijuana last year. But this bill would talk about what it would do. I mean, you're talking about marijuana, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, LSD, methadone, or amphetamine. You can describe what this is about. But, I mean, so people will not be arrested for small amounts of these substances. So what's at work here?
What's at work here is very small amounts. It does not change the laws on selling or distribution, and this is not legalization. But what we've seen over and over, and you see some movement in this at the state level and at the federal level, is that folks are trying to figure out what to do with all these people who've been put in jail for de minimis, meaning possession of small, very small amounts of drugs. And they end up spending years in jail, and then, of course, their lives are ruined. They can't get jobs, education, housing, and so on. So what these bills are trying to do is what we did for medical cannabis. It turns a criminal offense into a civil offense. It doesn't legalize it, but it says instead of getting a criminal offense, typically these are young people, making a stupid mistake. Drug use is not a good thing. It's a bad thing.
Right.
And then they get a criminal record. Then their lives are ruined. This says at the beginning, when you get those first arrests, you'll have a civil offense. And then the second offense, you're going to have a higher penalty. And the third one, they're going to be pushed into addiction treatment programs, whether they're short-term or long-term, or Narcotics Anonymous, methadone, buprenorphine, Vivitrol, faith-based, whatever the correct option is for each person. So it's to help people avoid the criminal record that we've got trying to solve now with things like in Maryland, the Justice Reinvestment Council are trying to figure out how to deal with parole and probation. This is trying to get on the front end to avoid these problems. And I know it sounds pretty shocking to folks, and probably a few years ago, I don't think I would have put these bills in. But having seen continually the consequences of this failed policy in my clinical life as an ER doctor and my life as a legislator, it just seemed time that we've to recognize that we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem.
So I want to push through these bills, but let me take a small detour here. I want to talk about what you just mentioned, which is your own growth in this. Because we've had conversations about this over the years and what you just talked about how, I mean, I remember how you've always been kind of on the progressive end of this issue, but never like this. So what's happened to Dan Morheim that has moved him in this direction?
Well, first of all, you're right. It's not new. I have next to me a report done from February 2001, Drug Treatment Task Force Report, Blueprint for Change, Expanding Access. That's 2001.
I remember that.
1999.
Right.
Shared by that Lieutenant Governor Townsend, and I was the vice chair, and we were talking about the importance of addiction treatment funding. But really what it is just a deeper recognition that things aren't working. The spiking violence and crime and murder rates. I was on duty in the emergency room at the hospital when a patient was brought in, gunshot wound, death. I was not involved in this care. I have been involved in this kind of care before, but not this particular failed resuscitation. And the next day, I read in the newspapers that it was the young man who was trying to build a little fence to keep some of the dealers out of his yard. His name was Kendall Fenner.
Oh, I remember that very well, sadly.
Yeah, and I was there, you know, and there was his body on the gurney. Mm. And, you know, I've seen that before. But, you know, it just struck home again that night and the following day. The number of patients I see in the emergency room who would like to get into treatment, some need coercion, some probably, I don't know what you could do for them, maybe some, hate to say it, some lost causes, but so many people are in there for so many other things, and we just aren't dealing with their substance abuse problems. So it's just cumulative over time. This is, problem's been around for a long time. I think there's much more public attention to it now because it's, frankly, because it's spread into suburban and rural America. This is not new to me, but sometimes when the public discussion shifts, you recognize that maybe now is the time to push the envelope a little bit.
So let me jump right to House Bill 1267, which I think if what I just mentioned might have opposition, this one might really raise hackles in terms of people wondering about what are you talking about? The polymorphone assisted treatment pilot program, the idea of finding a safe place for addicts to get high. I mean, talk about what that means.
Sure, but I do want to go back to one bill because I think it's more basic to the core
okay.
of this.
Okay, go ahead.
House Bill 908, and that basically says that hospitals have to have structured treatment programs for patients who present with substance abuse. Look, most people with substance abuse end up in an emergency room sooner or later.
Right.
They all do. And what we end up doing is giving them, in effect, a list of phone numbers. That's pretty unsuccessful even with folks that don't have problems. But if you came to the emergency room, Mark, with a heart attack, I hope not, but if you did, I don't give you phone numbers for local coronary care units and say, well, here, go find one. Instead, I arrange for you to be admitted to the hospital and get the specialist and the definitive care you need. But with substance abusers, that doesn't happen. And so what that bill says is that if you, hospitals have to have a substance abuse counselor there or available, and they have to have a defined place to get people into, whether it's in the hospital or in community-based treatment, long-term care, short-term care, but they have to have real arrangements made. And that, consistent with the new global payment system for hospitals, this will actually save them a great deal of money. And why should hospitals be the focus, at least an entry point? Not only because the substance use population ends up there for one thing or another eventually, whether it's a sprained ankle jumping out of a second-story window after stealing something or an overdose, all the way up to an overdose, but because hospitals are open 24/7, 365. There's no NIMBY issue, not in my backyard. Everybody knows where they are. We have occasionally, I'm sure you're aware, pushback from neighborhoods that don't want a methadone clinic in their neighborhood.
Right, right.
They're on bus routes, their safety, security. They're held financially accountable. Their records are public and reviewed by a state agency. So there's lots of reasons why hospitals need to step up to do this, and I really believe that's the major step. Now, there's always going to be a few outlier cases, some really tough folks that have failed everything. These people have failed every course of treatment, but they're out there committing some of the worst crimes and doing some of the greatest harm to the rest of society. And so this would be a pilot project. And what you would do with these folks, it's not just walk in, get drugs. It's completely different than that. They have to register, go through screening, very tightly controlled. And for those folks, we say, we're going to give you the drugs, but you're going to get involved in a therapeutic arrangement. These folks are otherwise shooting up in back alleys, in restrooms, in apartments by themselves. They're overdosing. The Safe Consumption Facilities deals with that, too. That's worked in Vancouver, Canada, and around the world. The number of overdose deaths in those facilities is essentially zero because you have trained medical personnel there to rescue folks. So you have to get people, you have to get people where they're at, not where you'd like them to be. You know, we'd all like these people to behave differently, but they're not. So we either continue to do what we're doing, which isn't working, or we try and reach out in new and creative ways. And these programs have worked around the world. There's data to show that, and we just have to tailor it to the Maryland circumstance. And it was the last one you mentioned, polymorphone treatment, would be a pilot program for 4 years under careful study and scrutiny with a report.
So two things. I mean, A, you can hear people listening to our conversation now going, wait a minute, we're going to give drugs to addicts. And that,
well, we give insulin to diabetics.
No, right.
We give inhalers to asthmatics.
But
you got to look at it from a public health point of view. I understand the anxiety.
Dan, is there's an existential leap for most people. This is about diabetes is one thing. This is an existential leap, I think, for most people in society to go, that I may not want to see drug addicts put in jail, but is the state becomes the pusher man. You know what I'm saying? So that's the first thing people hear.
Let me respond to that. I mean, the focus here is harm reduction. Now, let me put some specific numbers on it for our city. And, of course, you can expand it to the region and the state.
Right.
It's about 19,000 hardcore addicts in Baltimore City. They spend between $20 and $100 a day, 365 days a year, on their habits. Let's call it $50 a day. And I know this from studies. I know this from talking to substance abusers. Every shift that I work, I always check out the marketplace and what they're doing to get drugs and so on. So 19,000 times 50 times 365 is almost $400 million just spent by that subgroup to buy drugs. It doesn't count all the other costs, criminal justice, health care, costs on society. It doesn't count a whole bunch of other stuff. So if you imagine if you got just 5,000 of that 19,000 to 20,000 into a treatment program tomorrow, of whatever form it is, overnight, literally overnight, they would not have to commit the kinds of terrible things that they do to themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the rest of us. You would decompress the criminal justice system and you decompress the healthcare system and increase public safety literally overnight. So that's the rationale for saying, yeah, let's give them the drugs for this hardcore group, and it's better than what they're doing. Is it a good thing? Is it wonderful? Is that where we should all be? No. But what we've been doing isn't working, and so it's time to look at other things. And this has worked elsewhere.
So talk about the elsewhere. I mean, when you're talking about this polymorphone-assisted treatment program, which we can describe, and it's been going on in places in Britain, in Northern Europe. There's real success, I know, in Portugal on some of these programs. So talk a bit about what the data tells you about how this can work. And again, we're different societies. We're not Northern Europe. We're not Britain.
Right.
And we're not Portugal. But
well, that gets into like the hospital system bill because it's really designed for the Maryland system. The decriminalization for possession of small amounts is designed for Maryland. I get it. But, you know, substance abusers are substance abusers. Hearts and kidneys and biochemistry works the same regardless of where people are. And the data shows in these cases that some of the, you know, all of the fears that this would cause widespread havoc and increase drug use and attract druggies to places simply never materialized. And independent groups, like, for example, the Cato Institute studied Portugal. They found that all the parameters that people worried about did not happen, and the parameters that you'd want to see did happen. Less disease, less crime, less addiction, and so on. I mean, a lot of these folks you talk to substance abusers, they've suffered some pretty horrible things in their lives. Some, I think, are more biochemically driven, but most have suffered some horrible things in their lives. And they're just getting relief from really difficult situations, some of which is their own doing, for sure. There's no doubt about that. But when you get people into any kind of therapeutic environment, you start having a chance to improve their lives and reduce the harm that they do with the rest of us. Does law enforcement have a role? Absolutely. I work with police every shift. I get the important role that law enforcement has, and there are some folks that just have to be locked up for the safety of society. We can't help them. But a lot of folks can really be helped, and we ought to take advantage of that And it's clear what we've been doing hasn't been working. Otherwise, we'd be discussing how the drug rate has gone down. We'd be discussing how heroin is less available. We'd be discussing how the number of opioid deaths in the United States and in Maryland have dropped dramatically. We're not. We're talking about over the last year a surge in all these things, and it's been going on anyways. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. So these strategies have worked elsewhere, yeah, and we can tailor them to Maryland. We're smart enough to do that.
So let me ask you this couple quick questions here. So, A, how do we pay for these drug treatment programs? And, B, how do you pay for the polymorphine form program with drug addicts coming in to do their drugs within a clinical setting?
Well, that's a good question. And a big part of the answer is we're paying now or you pay later. It's like the oil filter ad. You want to pay on the front end a little bit, or you want to pay on the back end a great deal. So the hospital one's pretty straightforward, and that's actually the biggest to get people into programs without having to go further. Our Maryland hospital system is now under a global budget. It means hospitals are not being paid for having more patients in the hospital. They're being paid for keeping people out of the hospital. And that's a big shift, and it's going to take a few years for that cultural shift and the pieces and the mechanisms to get into place. But clearly, if that's a starting point, you can do that. Clearly, as you avoid people going into jail, you're going to start saving a lot of money. That's the decriminalization of just small amounts. Again, it's not legalization, and it's not legalization or any way of condoning or changing the penalties for selling or distribution. So you're going to avoid those problems, you know. And then when you get to the safe consumption facilities, those are going to be paid for the way the bill is drafted by institutions, could be a university, could be a church, could be a clinic that sets it up. And they would take care of those people. They would pay for it out of grants or funding. They could bill for legitimate medical procedures, not just for this part, but for the legitimate medical procedures and evaluations that they do. And, of course, ultimately, we all get to save money when there's police are able to do more service and less intense law enforcement. We'll have safer communities. So there are a lot of ways this pays for itself. And, frankly, in some places, they actually will charge the patients a modest fee in order to recoup some of the costs.
That's really interesting. So what now? Talk for a second before we go about the politics of this and where you are with it. I mean, these don't sound like easy bills to get passed.
Well, you're right. They're never going to be easy. But I would say that the response has been a little bit surprising to me. I really was braced for people saying that this was the worst and most terrible thing they'd ever heard. And, you know, and I can understand that because, as I said, maybe 5 and 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been in this position. But actually what I've met with is there's some of that, of course, very little, though, really none in the legislature. I mean, a couple of people kind of joked with me about it, but they know that I'm a serious person. They know that I always have backup data. I've done my homework, that I don't come in with ideas like this without having done the serious behind-the-scenes legwork that's required. So if anybody wants to challenge, I would say challenge me with your data because I'll respond with my data. And a number of people have said, I'm skeptical, but I want to learn more. This is really interesting. You're right. The war on drugs isn't working. That even to get to that point for a lot of people has been a big step forward. People are really recognizing that. And I know, Mark, you and I have had those discussions in the past. But
yeah.
3 or 4 years ago, I don't think there was consensus around that point. There is now. So people are open. And then quite a few people have come up and said, thank you for doing something new. You know, this particular one I like, this particular one I don't like, or this one I have some questions about. And I welcome, you know, critique and debate and engagement. And if other people have other ideas that work, I'm open to them. I'm not wedded to just these. You know, let people come forth with their own ideas, and that would be fine.
Delegate Dan Morehan, this has been fascinating. It really is. And these bills we're going to post on our website at standardshow.org as well. And make sure the public knows about this and continue this conversation during the course of the legislative session with you.
Thank you, Mark. I mean, this is an issue that eats at the very core of much of our society,
yes,
much of our city that we love, and much of the surrounding region as well. In fact, nationally, you know, I calculated, by the way, just on the money, that over $1.5 billion, maybe $1.25 billion dollars leaves Maryland every year for the purpose of goes into the drug cartel pockets. And actually, a lot of it ends up in the hands of ISIS and Taliban. So if that's just our little state. Now, run that through the United States and the rest of the world. You know, what we're ending up doing is operating under a policy that not only doesn't serve us locally or nationally, it's actually fueling financially entities that want to destroy our country. So it's really madness in a way, and we've got to break this cycle.
Delegate Dan Moreheim, also emergency room physician, 22 years, and our House of Delegates Deputy Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mark.
Maryland's 11th District. Thank you so much, Dan. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have to take a short break, but stay with us. On our way to break, I want to remind you to join us Thursday, March the 10th at 7 p.m. at the Carl J. Murphy Fine Arts Center here at Morgan State University for Baltimore's mayoral debate, co-sponsored by WEAA, City Paper, The Afro, and The Spokesman. Theme for the event is Ask, Listen, Vote, Solutions and Strategies for the Future. That's Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m. More information, WEAA.org.